You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, cultists, have you been missing us? We've been missing you. Don't worry, for the next hour or so, my dulcet yet very young-sounding tones will bring us back together as we take another look at a cinematic gem in this special bonus episode of Cult Classics. So turn on, tune in, and drop out with us. Now, all too often, the key word for each movie we look at, with a couple of, you know, notable exceptions, has been underrated. Well, today's movie definitely falls into that category. It's a horror, a comedy, and a homage to the horror genre itself. So come with us as we step over the rope for an exclusive private midnight viewing of Anthony Hickox's, may he rest in peace, Love Letter to Cinema, 1988's Waxwork. Not heard of it? Fear not, you're not alone on that one. This little gem, although generally loved by those in the know, isn't common knowledge unless you are a regular visitor to a video rental store in the late 80s. You'll be pleased to know you are forgiven, but I do urge you to go watch it before returning, unless you're unafraid of having it spoiled. Now, for the rest of you that do know this one, would you like a closer look? In that case, stick around as we take our regular geeky view at everything we loved and didn't love about the movie. I'm DK, and as usual, I'll be your host for this evening's deep dive, but also as usual, I won't be doing this alone. This time around, we have another returning guest. You last heard him on last year's Halloween special, where we spent the majority of the evening enamoured with Tom Atkins' moustache. He's a writer, a show host, a lover of genre film, and a self-confessed tapehead, and I can't think of anyone better to join me on this one. It's my man, Andrew Horn. How are you doing, fella?
Hello, mate. I'm very well, and I'm still in awe of the moustache.
Aren't we all? Aren't we? Yeah. I tried so hard to get one of those Tom Atkins figures afterwards, but it was an exclusive to the Congo, so I still don't have one.
That is such a shame, man. Hello, thank you for having me back. I'm looking forward to this. I just rewatched the movie yesterday, so I've not seen it in like a couple of years until coming to do this, and love it all over again. It's one of the oddest things.
It is completely absurd. I do respect it that it's a horror film and it's written by a, you know, a horror fan. So I'm looking forward to this one. So at this point, we normally ask our guests that, you know, that favorite cult movie, that sort of thing. But seeing as Andrew's been with us before, and we already know this, spoilers, it's trick or treat. Though if you want to know the full reasoning as to why, please check out last year's Halloween special featuring Andrew. So as we did earlier this year with the Kaiju Whisperer a couple months back, that's all ground that I'm not going to retread. So at this point, I'm going to ask you this one, fella. When you saw Trick or Treat, at that point, how involved were you into the horror genre? I mean, how long had you been a fan, as it were? And if you can remember it, what was your very first foray, for good or bad, into the field?
It was very, very early. In fact, it was one of the first three horror movies I ever saw. And it was rented for me as a very underage child by my very open-minded mother from the corner shop nearby our home. And it was the first one I got from there was Nightmare on Elm Street 3, and then that, and then Day of the Dead. So that was the three that introduced me to the genre. And I think not long after that, I got Basket Case as well from the same place. This is before we went to an actual video shop. It was a good opening, especially with Elm Street 3 and Day of the Dead. I know Trick or Treat has its faults, but I'm very, very enamored of it. It was a good start.
So it was more of a whoa moment rather than coming into the field gradually, yeah?
Yeah, it was especially with like the Romero movie, the visceral the visuals in that were quite a surprise. I'd heard of Freddy Krueger, so Elm Street 3 was a bit of a baptism of fire, because in my opinion, it is by far the best. But Trick or Treat took me by surprise because it also had it was the early days of me loving rock and metal as well, so it brought me into the whole world. I'm like, this is me, this is fantastic.
You'd found your home.
I had, and then it just twisted me further with things like Basket Case. I mean, what a grimy delight that thing is. I understand, actually, there's a, I can't remember if it's 2K or 4K, I think it's a 2K remaster of Basket Case coming out. I'm thinking, that's just going to look really weird in high definition, because it's such a grimy thing. The worst print possible is how you should see Basket Case.
Yeah, I'm going to say that's going to lose some of its charm if it's, you know, all tarted up like that.
Exactly. It's, I mean, even on VHS, you could see the mold lines around the edges of Belial, you know. But well, speaking of mold lines and waxy puppets, say, how's that for a segue?
Well, you obviously know your stuff regarding genre movies. Not only, you know, does your own show, Planet Hex, touch upon them a great deal, mm-hmm. but your book, VHS Ate My Brain, details your own love of these types of movies.
It does.
Now, I'm not disparaging today's filmmakers, but the 70s, 80s, even 90s to some extent, it was a very creative time in the movie-making industry. What is it about that era for you that is so magical as a cinema-goer?
One of the big things for me is physical effects, practical effects. Even now, with the advances in CGI and whatnot, I can't take it entirely seriously, because it often doesn't have weight to it. It doesn't look like it's there. You can see that the cast are interacting with something that isn't there. So a big thing in genre movies for me from like the 70s and 80s and some of the 90s was that they were clearly interacting with things that were there. You look at things like From Beyond, for example, when all the Lovecraftian nightmares are coming through the resonator, and you can see they are interacting with these big Vaseline-covered rubber monstrosities. And it just makes it more believable, even though they are less animated, you know, and they're less, they don't do as much as CGI effects can. They don't have the movement. You can't see the whole thing because you'd see the puppeteers and that sort of thing. But because of the weight of them, it has that extra bit of gravitas that just makes it real. And that's what really grabbed me. I mean, there's all kinds of things. I've got I'm working my way through the Arrow box set at the moment, the video store Arrow box set. It's got 5 Blu-rays in it, which is Dungeon Master, which I've really wanted to see again. I've not seen that in ages. Robot Jocks, Arena, Cellar Dweller, and Dolls. And Dolls in particular is a great example of physical effects done very well. Yeah, everyone's seen lots of killer doll movies, you know, like Child's Play and things like that. In the modern age, it's more things like Annabelle and so on. But yeah. That has one of the most unsettling elements I've ever seen in any killer doll movie. Spoiler alert, when the dolls are damaged, you can see tiny wet skeletons inside them. So like you crack the face and there's a little like red skull inside, and it's like, that's really upsetting. But because it's an animatronic or a puppet, it looks much more believable.
Yeah. I think the creativity on display back then is just something else. I mean, even when you take it down to its basic element, and you know, you look at the video covers for movies back then.
Oh yeah,
and often they were completely unrelated. Well, you know, I think we've got a prime example today, completely unrelated to the film itself, but yes, it sparked the imagination.
And how, I mean, Waxwork is a really great example of that, actually, because it was, it's one of the perennial ones I would see in every video store. So I would always see that there. I rented it a couple of times back in the day. And it was one of those that was in every store I would go to. Not so much when it became more about Blockbuster and the big chains, but when it was independent ones, you know, your average corner video shop, they would always have a copy of Waxwork. And it's got one of those cracking covers. It always have things like Neon Maniacs and Video Dead and things like that as well, which the covers of which sell them. And the cover of this really sells it, even though it's, apart from the framing, you know, with the butler welcoming you inside, apart from the framing of that, the image beyond it is it's very different to what you see in the film.
It is. It reminds me of, to some extent, of the film you mentioned earlier, Day of the Dead, which is the cover that kind of got me into hiring these things. And it's, again, you know, it's more applicable to Day of the Dead with the, you know, the multitude of zombies out there. But it is just very much a bunch of faces massed together.
It is. Yeah, it is. It worked, though, and we are in an age now where a lot of movie posters are literally just Photoshop faces floating in the air.
Yeah, this. I mean, speaking of, you know, the art and stuff, there has been a resurgence in recent years of this 80s aesthetic, from art itself to music to films. Do you think there's a longing in some respects of wanting to return to that time? I mean, obviously for our generation, it's a time of good memories. But it does seem to be something that now appeals to younger generations. Why do you think that is?
It instills more awe. It instills awe in something. I mean, you see something like the poster for The Last Starfighter, and it's got the great big text on it, and the characters looking up, and you've got the little image of the ship there, and it's like, okay, that looks great. I mean, now I would imagine that would be a little silhouette of one person with tiny text on it. There's a big thing for tiny text on things at the moment. But I think that we are arriving at a point in popular culture where the people that were into those things as kids are now creating them. I mean, one example would be our friend Matt, who worked in the same comic shop that we did many, many years ago, who now does posters for Marvel and Disney and things like that. And his aesthetic is absolutely this classic sort of awe-inspiring image. I mean, you can't beat painted covers. You can't beat painted covers. For me, my favorites would be by Graham Humphreys, who did things like Return of the Living Dead or the UK release of Nightmare on Elm Street, the first one that's all blue with like Nancy asleep and the claws coming over, and that sort of the composition of those things. It catches the eye, as well as the gaudy, you know, gory images on horror movies. They are eye-catching, and they do make you think, ooh, that could be good, that could be exciting. So definitely with Waxwork, you see the door with all the faces beyond it. It's like, okay, this looks good.
You're a self-confessed, as we said earlier, tapehead. What is it about the analog era that intrigues you? Is it purely nostalgia, or is there something else at play here for you personally?
There's a big nostalgia element for it, of course. There's absolutely a nostalgia element for it. But I do thoroughly enjoy being able to own a physical copy of something. I'm a big fan of physical media. You know, it comes and goes. It's enjoying a bit of a resurgence at the moment, because I think that streaming services have become much of a muchness, and people are starting to get fed up of having to remortgage their house to afford to watch each show that they want to see. And the tangible feeling of owning a copy of something, right? This is mine. This will live on my shelf. This will be a souvenir of me watching this movie. I think that's it's becoming a lot more attractive to people. And of course, with companies like Arrow and Shameless, and I think over in the States is like Vinegar Syndrome, and people that are putting out really good quality box sets and editions of movies that are making it more attractive. So, example, I watched Dungeon Master on off from the Arrow box that I mentioned earlier, and it had three versions of the movie on it, all different cuts, different titles, and then it had a wealth of interviews and commentaries and all sorts, and that sort of thing makes these things more appetizing for a consumer. To me, to they're getting more value than just being able to watch the movie itself. So I think extras are coming to their own again, but it's an interesting time because I've cut a couple of streaming services. We take a break from them now and again just because it just mounts up so high. You know, it mounts up so far, and if you're not getting the value out of it, just kill it for a month. I mean, even Netflix allows you to take breaks as well now, doesn't it, from your subscription. Instead of cancelling it, you can take a break for a couple of months, which I think is an interesting addition. But if you are using a streaming service, go for it. If you're really enjoying it and getting the value out of it. If not, you're best with physical copies for me. You watch it as many times as you like. It's not going to be taken down. It has that tangible feel of it. But with VHS,
you just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Chess, that is absolutely a nostalgic thing for me. I enjoy the artwork. I enjoy having them on the shelves. You know, I religiously watch the trailers on them. I never fast forward through the trailers, even if it's yeah. the worst junk possible. It's my junk, damn it.
Yeah, I remember. I think it was Day of the Dead. They had it had an advert on it for Vamp. And
yes,
there's one for this really what looked like a really tacky soft porn thing called the Men's Club, and I'd watch them, and I think on Elm Street too it was The Kindred and Deadly Friend, and
I had those on tape. Kindred is the trailer's better than the movie, but Deadly Friend is underappreciated. I like Deadly Friend.
Yeah, no, when people talk about Craven movies, they seem to kind of gloss over that one, which I think is a real shame.
It's strange, isn't it?
Yes.
Maybe, or the fact maybe that he did some TV movies as well.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's the Christy Swanson effect. I don't know.
Could well be. But there's an exploding head in it, so I'm sold.
I mean, I was thinking it's a shame that, yeah, while technology's progressed, so many of those classic and, you know, not so classic movies from that early video era, they've been lost. I mean, as the format's been retired, for the most part, the biggest titles, it's just those alone that are being updated and brought, you know. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of films out there that are slipping through the cracks.
They are. But that's why we're here.
It is.
That's what I want to capture in VHS in my brain. I did the original one in 2014. I did the revised version, came out in July 23. And there's the new one, VHS in my brain 2, The Revenge, which covers sequels. It's mainly about sequels, but also what's happened in the last 10 years since the first VHS in my brain came out. So that's, you know, because there is more of an awareness of old stuff now, I think. And people are rediscovering some of it, and more people are certainly rediscovering analog stuff, if not VHS, definitely Blu-rays and such like. Bit of a resurgence. I don't think it's ever going to be massive again, but, you know, it's nice to see people interested.
It is. I mean, I was coming at that. Your second volume of VHS ate my brain. I mean, it's now out there. What made you want to return to it? What brought you back?
It's been a decade since the original, and I still get messages from around the world on occasion, and photos of it being like red in other countries, and it really spoke to a lot of people. And I continued it in Scream Horror Magazine for a year as a column, and then kind of left it be, but it carried on getting all this interest, far more than all the other stuff I've put out. So I've put out lots of fiction and a bunch of stuff, but people seem to really latch onto it. And it struck me that a lot's happened since it came out. I did the revised version, which covered some of it, but I wanted to go deeper into what's happened with things like lunch meat becoming a big thing in the States and bringing back a lot of physical tapes. A lot of the documentaries that have come out, I didn't cover those in the first book. So, and I covered Adjust Your Tracking in there, but there's a bunch like VHS Lives and things like that. There's been more books, there's been zines, there's been gatherings all over the world, and it still has this deep, deep interest for a lot of people. And I just wanted to just carry it on because I missed it.
Well, you've dabbled in filmmaking yourself. What interests you in that field, and do you have any filmmakers that you would credit that you would say have influenced you?
Oh, crikey. So I for those that aren't aware, I made a movie during lockdown. I did a feature film during lockdown because I was going out of my head with boredom. About a million years ago, at the back end of the 90s, I worked for some low-budget, zero-budget film companies in Sheffield, where I'm from, making very strange, like David Lynch-type things for one guy, and then bawdy vampire shorts for another guy, none of which ended up finished. They all kind of ran out of money and stuff like that. There is a long story about the vampire movies where we were actually thrown off a set that we had because the people that owned it thought we were making a porn film. We weren't. We just happened to have 9 attractive ladies and 1 man in the cast. It was a vampire comedy, that one, and it was really funny. And cut a long story short, we got thrown off that location, and as we were leaving, as the crew packed up, the producer said to me, "Can you write us another one we can do tonight in an office?" I went, "All right." So I had to write another short while driving to the place to film it. That mostly got finished. I don't know if that ever got edited and released, but yeah, that was a bizarre day. But that's a story for another time. Stories about that night. That was crazy. Sorry, dude. Oh,
gosh. No, I was just going to say, so you were telling us about the lockdown movie.
Oh, yes. I made a lockdown movie called The Demon and I, and the idea was to... I asked a bunch of friends on Facebook, including yourself, to volunteer to be in it and read some dialogue. And as people came in, I would write dialogue for them and send it over. And the idea was to make a mockumentary about a disgraced paranormal investigator that I played. And all the other people in it would be interviewees. So I'd invent backstories from them and such like. And chaos would ensue with... the possession happening towards the end again. The main influence for that, to be honest, was Ghostwatch. It wasn't a movie. It was the Ghostwatch special. I mean, anyone from the UK of a certain age, just the mention of Ghostwatch,
yeah,
is unsettling.
Yeah, pipes. Oh my god.
Yeah, exactly. It has that magic. You know, that's all I wanted to do, was to make something a bit like that, and to make my give my friends something to do for a bit while we were all in lockdown. And it came out far better than I expected. We had CGI effects in it, and we got like proper music done for it, and it was all kinds of cool stuff going on with it, and ended up being interviewed on the BBC. And of course I went on the BBC at BBC Radio, and the first thing they did was say, "Is that really your surname?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And then they played a load of ghost noises, so thanks, Beep. I've written movies for a producer in the States. I wrote 3 for a lady in the States, one of which was going to go forward just before lockdown. So thanks, COVID. That is currently on the shelf. And I do have a couple of things coming up that I can't talk about. I love being able to say that, man. What a satisfying thing to say. It's like, there is a thing, but I can't talk about it. Sure some people just say that when they've got nothing going on. They're just like, they've got to be secretive. But no, there is a thing. I've been influenced by, I would say, Wes Craven. I would say, oh man, probably Charles Band from all the Full Moon movies and Empire movies I've watched. It's a mixture of things, but mainly that was Ghostwatch.
But I've got to ask you strictly, and this is strictly for personal reasons. Yes, are there any plans to bring back the character of Tom Sheridan at any point?
I would love to. I would love to. If I do, there is a sequel written. There is another one written based around the character of Candice, who was played by my friend Charlotte, who's a great actress, and she's a great director as well. But if we ever do that, then I'll stick him in. Don't worry.
Oh, fantastic. That's, I appreciate that, mate.
You did a great job.
Wink, wink. I'll slip you a fiver later. So, yeah, that's awesome, mate. Thanks. So, yeah, Andrew's current book, VHS Ate My Brain, The Revenge, as well as the first and his many other titles, are available now on Amazon. And I highly recommend checking that out. And with that, yeah, we're going to go straight from one love letter to cinema to another with today's movie. Now, Waxwork is a 1988 American comedy horror film written and directed by Anthony Hitchcock in his directorial film debut. It's partially inspired by the 1924 German silent film Waxworks. It stars Zach Galligan of Gremlins fame, along with Deborah Foreman, Michelle Johnson, David Warner, Dana Ashbrook, and Patrick McNee. It was initially budgeted at $3 million. Now, Hickox got the gig after visiting Los Angeles and crashing into another car. As luck would have it, the driver, Stefan Arenberg, producer of Jersey Girl and The Quiet American, was looking for a script to produce. So Hickox proceeded to write Waxwork over the next 3/4 days, and the pair moved forward with the project. The movie, with the tagline "Stop on by and give the afterlife a whirl," again, to me that just seems completely unrelated as the cover, was given a limited release in the US by Vestron Pictures in June 88, grossing $808,000 at the box office, with a VHS release in both R and unrated editions coming soon afterwards that same year. Now, critical reception was mixed on the movie, with some praising its creativity and others criticising its execution. Despite this, it did well enough to receive an albeit straight-to-video sequel with the mostly same cast and crew, and despite its initial reception, Waxwork has garnered a dedicated fan base who appreciate its unique blend of horror and comedy. And it can be currently found on streaming services, as always, depending on where you're located, as well as being available on DVD, Blu-ray, and for the benefit of today's guest, I'm sure there are also many copies on tape still floating around out there.
There are varying prices. Look for a low one.
So, I mean, when I first heard about this, it was one of those that I knew I had to see. I was a pretty regular reader of Fangoria at that point.
And good lad.
They did. Yeah, oh, I miss those days. And they did a feature on this upcoming movie called Waxwork. I believe the tagline on the cover was, "It puts the blood back on the screens where it belongs."
Yes.
And the article was showing shots of the vampire section. I mean, I thought it looked amazing. So I actively searched it out to no avail. It never hit screens in the UK, or at least it didn't where I lived, in the remote wastelands of the north of England. So it slipped into legend for me. I'd practically forgotten about it by the time it came back onto my radar. I was still relatively young. Around 20 minutes walk from my house, there was this little corner shop. And it was like the one that you were referring to. They'd started doing VHS rentals. The owners were really cool people. And yeah, okay, I had a mad crush on their daughter. But that aside, every time my parents were away, I'd take a walk down there, look at the rack, and, you know, usually go home with 2 or 3 horrors. And then I turned up one day, and Waxwork was just sitting there on the shelf. I mean, I couldn't be sure if it was that Waxwork. Let's be honest, you know, the cover, as we've said, doesn't exactly represent the movie.
No.
But yeah, just the prospect was exciting. It was like finding a back issue of a comic book you've been searching for ages. And yeah, I'm a nerd, guys. Big shock. So yeah, I snatched it up,
yep,
raced home.
It.
Yeah, I know, it's, you know, I keep it on the DL. And yeah, I just enjoyed the hell out of watching TV that evening. I haven't looked back since, and at the risk of giving away the ending of today's show, I've owned it in one format or another since. So, I mean, I'll be honest, I wasn't planning on doing this one for another couple of seasons, but when I heard about the sad passing of Anthony Hickox late last year.
Yeah,
I just had to put it on the schedule because I just think he deserves credit for this one. So yeah, what about you, mate? When was the first time you ran into this?
It was the early 90s. So this will be mid 90s. So I think one edition of it on VHS here came out as a 15, if I remember rightly. Either that or they just let me rent it on my own far earlier than they should have. I think they just liked me because I was in the video shop like every day. It was my favourite place in the world. And I was expecting, I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting what the film was like. Because it is demented. I was expecting like a really straightforward horror movie. But at that point, I was renting a lot of things that were described as horror comedies, but the comedy was quite light. You know, it wasn't like a major aspect of it. There's more of a comedy aspect in this, but it's got kind of this mix of like Bill and Ted with all the going into different worlds and in different parts of this strange multiverse that there is. There's bits of like Time Bandits and all kinds of stuff mixed into this weird ass film. It is so weird, but it's so good about it. It's just because it's so ridiculous. You can't look away, and it has been made with great love. I mean, even the right at the end of the credits, it does say it's dedicated to Hammer, Argento, Romero, Dante, Landis, and things. Right before the like the copyright number at the end, it's dedicated to the filmmaker, these other filmmakers, and you can see it's been made with tongue in cheek, but also with enormous love for the genre. And I remember watching it and just thinking, what? This what? Yeah, I liked it, but it was very strange because it got several gore scenes in it, but it also had this sort of light-hearted adventure romp mixed into it as well. It's really odd.
It is. When it started, when it...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
When I first watched it and Zach Galligan shows up on screen.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, I must have got the wrong movie. This cannot be the one that they were talking about in Fangoria.
Exactly. I mean, it's got a fantastic cast. It's such an unexpected cast. You know, it's got Zach Galligan, Deborah Foreman, David Warner. It's got all kinds of really weird people in it that you just wouldn't expect. John Rhys-Davies is in there as a werewolf.
Yeah, that is something I never expected to see in my lifetime until I sat down and watched this movie. It's completely gonzo.
It is nuts. It's like, what genre is it? It's like, well, it's sort of horror, but it's sort of comedy. It's sort of like Twilight Zone sci-fi adventure. And it's mad. But that's a great thing. It's a great hook for it. It makes it stick out. And I think it's not just a slasher or something like that. It's really different.
It literally throws everything against the wall, and I think that's part of its charm.
Yeah.
I mean, something that's been very apparent to me watching it this time, and I know you've watched it recently, is just how 80s this movie is. Is that something that you were cognizant of this time around?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I got that when they first go in, they get invited. I'm having a private showing at midnight. It's like, that's not sinister at all. Yeah, like, bring your mates over to a sinister, to David Bloody Warner. Yeah.
To a waxwork that wasn't there building. Yesterday.
Yeah, a special midnight showing, but don't bring more than six people. All right. Yeah, I'll bring my mates along. So that, and the mates turn up and they're all that sort of irritating 80s bad guy, apart from Zach Galligan, Zach Galligan's character, Mark, the rest of them, they're all kind of irritating. So by halfway through, you hope they all die horribly.
Oh, that's gotta hurt.
It is a very 80s movie, and some of the effects that are used, like there's a guy getting his face caved in and it's kind of stretching out and it's bubbling up, and there's bladder effects used under the latex, and it's like, this is so glorious.
Yeah, I think it's when Dana Ashbrook was undergoing his first werewolf transformation.
That's it. That's the one.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Shades of Manimal.
Yes. Oh, God, Manimal. But now, it does have so many great things about that era in it, including the nonsensical fantasy style story.
Yeah, that again, that's something that I didn't expect. I thought it was just going to be a straight-laced horror, and it's literally all over the place. You can't, and once you do start to pin it down, it changes direction again.
Yes.
And I just love it. I just love it. I'm spoilers for the end of this episode, but the writing, to say that he cobbled this together in 3 days, credit where it's due. It's just, I don't know how much, you know, Brazilian matching powder was involved in this, but it was obviously money well spent, because holy crap, it's and more often, and you know, more than that, it also, for its two, you know, can its two, we'll get into it in a bit, for its two main leads, it has a little character arc going on.
It does have a character arc, yes, you're right.
You would think there wouldn't be enough time for it. And when and it's really odd, when I watch it now, for the first 30 minutes, I was sat there going, I'm not sure this is holding up for me. And then it kicked into gear once more, and then by the end of it, I would die on the hill of defending this thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. It does sort of kick in at the half hour mark, and start to gel together, even though everything is so disparate in it. You know, the scenes with the vampires, and there's mummies, and there's the lengthy scene with the dinner table with the raw meat being eaten, and it just keeps going all over the place. There's that really shocking shot in the like in the operating theatre stroke morgue type room, where he's got his leg hanging off.
Yes.
And it's all exposed. It's, oh my God. There's some shocking visuals in it.
Yeah, but then not 3 minutes later, it's used for comedy effect, where the vampire's trying to leap over the table and ends up kind of pressing on his leg. And he's just like screaming out in pain, and you're not sure whether you should be laughing or not. And I love that. I just love it to bits. If you can tell, listeners, I'm quite enthusiastic about this. Yeah,
it is marvelous, though. I mean, I don't think it could have been made in any other era, because there was that huge wave of ridiculous creativity in the, I would say, like, you know, 87 to like 93, where genre movies just went completely mental, and we ended up with things like Freaked. You remember Freaked, the Alex Winters movie?
Yes. Yes.
With some incredible makeups, and going back to Basket Case, there were two Basket Case sequels with lots more Belials in them, where the effects were just completely deranged. You had people like Screaming Mad George and KMB coming into their own with the effects work, and it was just utterly marvelous. A great time to be picking up things, because you did not know what to expect.
No. And you try for so long after, when I was telling my friends about this, I'm trying to describe it to them. And I'm just saying, so anyway, there's this vampire, and then 5 minutes later, but this werewolf, and they're like, hold on, I thought you said this was a vampire movie. And it's just got that much in it. I mean, I'm gonna, you know, I've been obviously doing the research on it. There's 18, for those who haven't seen it, there's 18 horror exhibits in this, which includes Count Dracula, the Phantom of the Opera, a witch, the Marquis de Sade, a werewolf, a mummy, a voodoo priest, zombie, An urban legend killer, the Invisible Man, Frankenstein's monster, an invasion of the Body Snatchers pod, a demonic baby, an alien creature, a Cobra Man circus freak, Jack the Ripper, Mr. Hyde, and a golem. And, yeah.
And David Warner.
Yeah, well, yeah, David Warner outstrips them all.
Yeah.
I mean, there were three characters, apparently, that were supposed to be displayed. But they had to be left out for legal reasons. He wanted to get in the children from Village of the Damned.
Okay.
He wanted to get in the creature from The Thing, and he also wanted Jason Voorhees in there. Now, in the shooting script, where the jock's there, and he's looking at the Phantom of the Opera, when he tells Lincoln, it looked just like the Phantom of the Opera mask. That had to be changed because that was supposed to be Jason Voorhees. And he said, it looks just like the Jason mask from the movies. And that's when Lincoln says, they made a movie about the Jason killings. And hence they'll make a movie about anything nowadays. But yeah, they had to remove it. Although I'm not sure, I'm guessing you've seen the sequel, yeah?
Lost in Time many years ago. I've not revisited that one. But I have seen that a long time ago, and it's not that entirely connected. Although just some of the cast do come back, don't they?
Yeah, I think Deborah Farmer didn't come back because apparently at the time, while the original was going, she was having a relationship with Anthony Hickox.
Yes.
And they ended up in what he describes as a quite messy breakup. Mm. And obviously she was reluctant to return for the sequel. But
I mean, that sequel did have Bruce Campbell in it.
It did. And, an absolutely fantastic alien homage as well. But he does manage to sneak in a Jason Voorhees reference in that. So I am quite proud of Anthony for that one. But from what I can gather as well, looking into the writing of this one, it also brought up problems with regards to the direction, because obviously it was the first time that he directed this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And Hickox's father apparently had always told him, never wait to shoot the end of your film last, because you'll usually run out of money or time.
Yes.
And he was like, no, I'll be fine. And then it happened. And he actually planned 4 days of what he describes as time hopping action.
Yeah.
And it all had to be abandoned. And in his own words, he said, so it was done in a single day, and the time hopping action was, so we had to do a pub fight. and I just love this just approach to it. I just think it's really good. I mean, he obviously got that time hopping thing in the sequel.
Yes.
But I can't imagine this film without that pub fight with this army of OAPs.
No, it's so hard to explain what it is.
And when you start it, it starts off like a murder mystery from its setup, where, you know, this masked intruder is putting Lincoln's head in the fire.
Yes.
And then once it goes in and the credits start rolling, the music, I almost expect to see the name Peter Falk as Columbo come up in the title, because it starts off like an almost TV movie murder mystery.
Oh, could you imagine that? I understand you got a problem with your Max works. I can't do his voice.
That was pretty good. But I don't doubt for a second that Hickox, had he the budget and had he a bit more time, would have thought at some point, yeah, let's do that too.
It's deranged. And that is the main reason why people should watch it, especially now, as we've gone through an era of many, many remakes of things and reboots, and we've gone through a lengthy era of Annabelle knockoffs and, you know, Conjuring knockoffs. And if you look up horror on, say, like Amazon Prime, there are tons of possession movies, lots of things that have a poster with a spooky looking lady on the front of it, probably with black or white eyes.
Yes.
You know, and to have something like Waxwork, which is just demented, not demented in like a brain dead way, where it's just out and out gore, but just demented in like what is have I fallen asleep in one film and woken up during another one? It's so disparate. The elements of it are so disparate. However, it does gel because you've got the overarching narrative of it being part of this waxwork that has access to these little bubble dimensions. And once you get your head around that, it makes much more sense, but it's still just crazy.
But yeah, they still find time, as we say, to get these character arcs in. And sometimes it's quite uncomfortable watching the arc that Sarah goes through, Deborah Foreman. I don't know how you feel watching that.
It's not easy. That's one of the elements that hasn't really dated so well, because it does kind of revel in it, you know? I have an odd relationship with things that haven't really aged well, because I always try and watch them in the context of the era they were made in, and some things still don't sit well at all. But you try and contextualize it, but some things just don't work anymore, and that is one of those things for me. But it could have done with being trimmed down a little bit, that particular arc. But overall, it doesn't spoil the movie. It doesn't take away from what is an unsung piece of nutty goodness.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this back in the 1941 episode. There's a certain, mm-hmm. there's a certain element of that movie that really hasn't aged well, and this is, I'm not going to say similar. This hasn't aged well. It's not anywhere near as egregious as that one.
No.
But as you say, it tends to linger on it a little too much, and it doesn't make for comfortable viewing. I mean, it does give the character her agency back, because she turns from this, what I would say, quite timid damsel in distress type.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by the end, she's the one kicking ass, you know, saying kiss this and headbutting people and, you know, throwing the little butler into the pod. And I mean, I've got to say, I do love the look on her face when she, at the end, when she buries the axe in Desaad's back. I mean, she's the one who defeats him, not Mark.
Yeah.
And I just think that, you know, at that point, you kind of are punching the air. But to get to that point, you do have to go through a couple of really kind of, you know, grit your teeth kind of scenes.
Yes, you do. Some things do age well, some things don't. Things where people are put in peril, that doesn't always sit well, and can feel kind of voyeuristic.
Yes.
And uneasy. But then they jump to another universe, and then there's, you know, crazy wax going all over the place.
Yeah, I do like that those scenes were offset with that, and I do have to give him credit for this. That brilliant, absolutely.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy, just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Brilliant homage to Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the black and white section, yes.
Yeah, it looks
so good. Oh, man,
so
it's spot on.
You know, they've got the mist. Oh, yeah. Honestly, if you love horror, you will love this. There's so many Easter eggs. When there's a couple of off moments in the movie itself, but I would say you're looking at maybe 5% of the film, and the rest of it is just, to me, gold. It's just pure gold. Some of the homages, some of the references, you know, even down to the comedy moments, like the, you know, the feed me kind of thing with the pod. And then the bit that always cracks me up in that scene is Dracula turns into a bat and the make my day line. It's the very last thing you expect. And you know, and this is in a movie which is full of things that you don't expect. But to see Dracula kind of taken out like that, it's just, you cannot help but kind of, I mean, I just crease up every time at that one. I don't know what that says about me. And I have to do it. I have to do the joke. You know, Dracula, we haven't mentioned him yet. Andrew, how much O'Keefe is in this movie?
Not enough.
Oh, I mean, I had no idea who the guy was, if I'm being completely honest, when I first watched it. But to see Miles O'Keefe in a movie and not have Miles O'Keefe be the weirdest actor in the movie and him actually be quite restrained, I think Hickox pulled off a feat in itself, kind of there.
After being in stuff like At All, The Invincible and things like that, you'd imagine he would be...
God. Oh my goodness, that was painful to watch, even in the Mystery Science Theater version. So to see this, oh, there is that line though, that where he delivers that steak tartare. Oh yes, steak tartare.
And that you just was say, so funny.
Yeah,
where she just kind of gives in and she looks down. It's like, that's clearly not steak tartare, and the sauce is clearly unpleasant as well. So like, oh,
yeah, but
on.
The sauce makes the dish.
Oh, it does. It does. Clearly a gravy boat of blood, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I also love some of the lines in this. That there's every now and again, there's a little sparkle of dialogue like that, you know, at the start where Mark's trying to light his cigarette. Mm-hmm. And he's obviously being played left, right and centre by China. And, you know, China's like, can't a girl get laid around here without being burned at the stake? And Tony's response is, you know, to his cigarette, anyone got a light? Yep. But then she, you know, she comes back with that vicious comeback and you're just like, yeah, I'm not going to mess with her.
There are some great lines in it. I mean, I can't remember her name now. It's, I hear you having drinks with the butler the other night. Now, you know, that sort of thing leads to anarchy.
Yes. You know. And then you have the admirer of Hitler teaching history. With the thing on the chalkboard saying, fascism, does it work?
A message from 2024, no.
Yes.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. Still doesn't.
So, yeah, I think there's so much good stuff in here. And I think if you give it a, you know, just a cursory glance, especially that first half hour, you think...
Yes.
This is not going to work for me. I'm going to go and watch Megan or something like that. And I think people that would do that, bearing in mind my own response to Megan, I think they're doing themselves a disservice to dismiss this.
I think there is still, for people that haven't seen stuff of this era, I think there is still a lot of entertainment value, despite, you know, it looking very much like an 80s movie, having that look, having that film feel, having the physical effects and the limitations of the time, it still has a lot of entertainment value. I strongly believe that about any era. You know, I watch movies from like the 30s onwards, and there's something about every one of them that can be enjoyed, even if it's like the worst made thing possible. There is some entertainment value to be taken out of it, and there definitely is with Waxwork. Just because, like I say, it's that era where like the brakes were off for a while, and we'd had the Freddies and the Jasons and the Michael Myers, and a lot of companies started just putting out the most weird things, you know, just to see what would happen. And like you said earlier, like the kitchen sink sort of approach to this, throw everything there, something's got to stick, and it does. It works in its own self. It's so hard to describe what sort of film it is to anyone. But it's sort of horror, it's sort of comedy, it's sort of... Just watch it. What you can do to sell it to anyone is to say it's not House of Wax with Paris Hilton in it.
Well, I mean, you know, that would sell pretty much anything. Let's be fair. I mean, and it's really weird because apparently the producers were turned down by every single studio they approached with regards to this. And that's including Vestron.
Really?
But the company's head apparently was, I think, a little bored one afternoon. So he just flicked through the script and immediately reversed his decision.
So that's the thing, because it could not be any more Vestron, this. It was literally, there's no way anyone else could put this out. It needed a Vestron logo on it. And it's just, it pays off. You know, you see some films and it's like, this was a Canon film. This was an Orion film. Yes. And this has got Vestron absolutely all over it.
I mean, I can't watch it. If, you know, if I put a Vestron movie on and that logo comes, I cannot register it as a Vestron without hearing the big band version of Sing 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 in my head. Such has this movie colored my perception of the world around me. So
I wonder if he grew up messed up, man.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, during the scene in the basement at the vampire's mansion, the crew on the set said it was, and I quote, the bloodiest thing they'd ever put to the screen. Now, that alone, I mean, obviously it's been surpassed so much since.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know, back then you could really see it. And, you know, I mean, much of the gore obviously was cut. But there are some nasty, nasty sequences in this, you know,
there
such
really
as the vampires,
are.
You know, the servant in the Egyptian sequence.
Yep. It's, oh, when he gets his head trampled.
Yes. But for every moment like that, you have those comedy moments. I mean, you know, we've had the ones that I've mentioned, the pod person and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. You have that brilliant little scene in the werewolf section where the guy smacks the werewolf with the chair.
Yes.
And the werewolf just like kind of brushes it off really nonchalantly. I love that. But even then, there's some subtle comedy moments. Like, well, I hate to, you know, say it's subtle, but Sir Wilfred's battle chair. And
subtle?
Yes. But and also the look of incredulity on Junior's face when Jenkins is killed and Mark goes over to see him and Jenkins says, get those bastards. And Junior's just sat there at the side of him. And the look on his face as Mark, like, gets up and has his hero moment with the sword. It's like the character itself is not taking the film seriously. And I love that. I mean, you know, just little touches like the Marquis de Sade later on. He's fighting, and every time he's fighting, he gets his hair in his eyes. So he's constantly brushing the hair out of his eyes. You know, I'm surprised that Hickox didn't make it bigger.
Yeah.
In the movie world, because I think he had so many great ideas.
It could well have been, though, that things like this put larger audiences off because it was hard to quantify. You couldn't just say it's an action movie, it's a thriller, it's a horror movie, because it was so different. And that may have got in the way of bigger projects, of things getting wider known.
Yeah.
It's something quite, it's I do love fun. About it, though, is the you know, the effects when they're going between the universes, the like blue and white animations that go around them as they cross
the,
over,
like ripples. Yeah.
Yeah, I find those really endearing because they've clearly been done like almost like cel shaded animation over the film. It's lovely. It almost makes me think of Quantum Leap, the original Quantum Leap.
Yes.
I love that. Any energy effects like that, I just adore.
Yeah, like that in the Night of the Living Dead section where he hits that wall.
Yes.
And he's feeling around and the ripples are extending out from his face. It's 40 years old almost, but it still looks good to me.
There's the artistry is obvious. It's not just being thrown together on a computer. I mean, there's definite artistry to do in CGI. There's absolutely definitely artistry to that, but the fact that these effects could be pulled off with animation and superimposition and forced perspective and rubber and animatronics and stuff, that it just, it's so impressive that it comes together so well.
Yeah. I mean, I should mention that the effects lead on this is Bob Keane, you know, who did Hellraiser and Nightbreed, that kind of thing. And it's really good. I mean, the resurrection scene towards the end, I love the look of the snake man, the cobra, the little cobra guy, as he's kind of waking up. I just think it plays tonally, it's all over the shop. Because, yes, one minute you're laughing, one minute you're feeling uncomfortable. But then it comes to this and you're just kind of awestruck. And, you know, I did see it when I was a little younger, so it's kind of terrifying at the same time. Especially when, you know, David Warner's, you know, twirling his metaphorical mustache. Oh, God, we're back to mustaches. But he's, you know, he's gloating and the exhibits are kind of waking up.
Yeah.
And that set, to me, is a feat in itself of production design. I love the setup.
Even when you know it's fake and you know it's all pretend and it's makeup and costumes and lighting, it comes together really well and gives it that atmosphere.
I mean, I will say when they first go in and you're seeing the exhibits, and obviously, you know, these exhibits are played by actors, they're not entirely convincing as waxworks, but... Because you know what's
or
coming.
Or as actors.
Yeah, fair enough. Because, that woodsman. My goodness, what shortlist was he from? It plays with your mind because, you know, you can see them. They're not the best at remaining still.
No.
But it gives you that kind of vibe as in, are they real or not? And when you see this for the first time, you automatically expect them to come to life. So when they don't, you're just like, oh, that's okay then. And then you get that scene where Tony enters the werewolf section after his lighter. And you think, oh, okay, what's going on here? I think it's done wonderfully. And I think the production design on that sense, across the board, I think it's really well. And I mean, it ties in again to Hickox's directing. When you look at that vampire section and Michelle Johnson's costume in that, and she's running down the corridor, and the curtains are billowing behind her, and there are some shots in this movie that to me, as a lover of cinema, are just perfect.
Also, that's good if you like Bonnie Tyler videos.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, you could overlay Total Eclipse of the Heart on that one and think, that works. That really does. It sells it. But it's incredibly atmospheric. And I do like the fact that he doesn't, you know, as with the Night of the Living Dead one, he kind of takes things at a different directorial angle for each section.
Yeah, and plays those straight.
Yeah.
And really gives it the homage that he was after.
Yeah. And then you get all, you know, you get scenes like just the little transitions from the wax bubbles to the real world when Tony's transforming into the werewolf and he's, you know, the guy comes in and shoots him and he's dying. And then it just pans away and he's there in the display and it just pans to Mark as he's walking past. I think that's done really well also.
That is a good one.
And the other one that I do appreciate is the one where, you know, the cop goes to the house. He's obviously dragged there by Mark and he tells Mark, just go home. You're talking out of your ass, kid. And then later on, he's in his office and suddenly he starts recollecting the faces from these displays. And it's the faces of those missing people. And you're looking at it top down through the ventilation fan.
Yep.
And I think that's done really well. It really, you know, hammers that home. Although I will point out that those posters, the posters of the missing people, they're copies of the posters from the opening credits of The Lost Boys.
I did not notice that. That's epic.
In the words of John Hammond, no expense spared.
Absolutely.
And you
just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. and listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I don't know if you noticed this, but I swear, in the attic where they're looking through the artifacts, and they open the newspaper and it shows David Warner as Lincoln, I will put money, I've looked, I can't find anything confirming or denying it, I will put money that that is a promo picture from Tron, him as Dillinger.
Oh, right. I'm going to have a look at that now, because that's, I love Tron. I love Tron dearly, and any related Tron Easter eggs, that's a good thing for me. I'm going to have to go and have a look at that again later on.
Just, there's something I have to ask. We're of the same age range. When you when you see the last bit where Lincoln falls into the vat, is it just me? When he rises out of the vat to grab hold of Zach Galligan, a lot of the time I'm expecting Kenneth Williams to come out of there shouting, "Frying tonight."
Frying tonight, that'd be amazing. It looked like good, messy fun they were having.
It did. And I love the fact that you have the exposition, and the exposition is pretty much all delivered by Patrick McNee, because up until that point, you don't have a clue what's going on. Mind you, even after that, you're not 100% sure. But
no, but it did need someone of his caliber in order to deliver that exposition without just someone going, "Look, it's exposition."
Yes.
So it did need someone a bit better than the rest of the cast. Nothing against Zach Galligan or anyone like that, but it was, it's Patrick McNee. Come on.
Exactly. And I do like the fact that, I mean, apparently David Warner was only on set for 2 days. He did fit a lot into those 2 days. but I do like the fact that at the end, you expect the exposition to come, and Zach Galligan says, "Why do you want to end the world?" And you're expecting this speech, and he just basically shrugs and says, "Well, somebody has to."
Yeah, it's a really good line that. It kind of takes the wind out of his sails a bit. Instead of saying they all must fall in a vat of horror, it's like someone's got to do it.
Yeah. It goes without saying that Warner's a fantastic actor. But I think with just a look in this, he convey that switch. One minute is this nice as pie gent, and then he gets the hand on the people's back and pushes them in,
cold.
And then switches. It's like later on when he's, when Junior snaps the neck on the cop, and he sit down and he's comforting Junior, and then he looks down at the body and just says, "Get rid of that. It's useless."
Yeah.
And as a counterpoint to that, then you have Patrick McNee getting his head ripped off by a werewolf, and his last words are, "Oh my goodness." So, yeah, I mean, we're on to the acting now. And it's funny that you mentioned, the Freddies and the Jasons, because Kane Hodder's actually in this. I don't know if you know.
Is he?
Yeah, he's, ironically enough, he's the one playing Frankenstein.
Well, I never.
It's apparently an uncredited role, and I'm guessing Hickox hired him for the Voorhees kind of setup before that was scuppered.
That was really cool.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Well, I am getting a lot of this stuff from the internet, so obviously it's the internet, so take it with a bucket of salt. If I am, speaking erroneously, then please, someone, let me know. What surprised me about this is, I mean, Zach Galligan, he had a huge, huge hit back in 1984 with Gremlins.
Yeah.
And other than this, you didn't really see that much of him.
No. Which was kind of a surprise.
And went, yeah.
He did have that quality in Gremlins where it was like, okay, there's a, not like another Michael J. Fox, but, someone else that we can latch onto through this era.
Yeah, he he's obviously playing a different type of personality than the one he was doing in Gremlins. I mean, let's be fair, he starts off a little bit of a prick in this one.
And yes, he does.
Yeah, he does grow into himself. Although Galligan, he hated that Hickox continually made him tuck his shirt in. especially for the scene where his character leads the police to the museum.
Right.
The reason why he recalls catching the movie on USA's Up All Night once, right. And it was hosted by Gilbert Gottfried. And it showed that scene, and Gilbert Gottfried said, "We'll be right back with Waxwork starring Zach Galligan after 40 cheeseburgers." And yeah, apparently he wasn't very happy at that.
Oh dear! But if you look down the rest of the stuff that Zach did, he did kind of go from this promising start to more like video stuff. I mean, he was in Cyborg 3. And Warlock the Armageddon and stuff like that. I mean, Warlock the Armageddon is great, but it was straight to video. And
I think that's an actual. I think that's a Hickox again. I'm going to come to the sound design. And what did you think to the sound design on this one?
It helped it. It helped to keep things moving nicely. There's a great score to it. There's some nice touches with the sound effects, and like you say, the feed me and all the little nods to other films in there with the effects and little snippets of dialogue. I liked it. It didn't stick out. It didn't stick out too much. I don't remember a particular theme like to the score or anything like that, but it did keep you in the moment, and the effects and the atmospherics kept you very much in the moment with it. So I liked it. Plus, it does the sound design does actually differ between each bubble universe. Each little location, it's got like a little subtle difference to the ambience of it, like the Egyptian sequence, the pyramid sequence with the mummy. There's like a low rumble. I remember that, and in like the in the vampire sequences in the vampire's house, there's a little more reverb. There's a little more space to it. To make it sound like a larger place. Of course, it would have been on a sound stage or something like that. But there are some subtle things with the sound that do work really well with it.
When it comes to that, I'm normally a soundtrack person. So mm-hmm. whenever someone asks about sound design, the general sound design goes right over my head because I'm normally focusing on the score.
So there's a lot that is done in this with the sound to make it seem a little bit more higher budget, it does work in making some of the sets appear more believable.
Yeah. With regards to the music, it's a bit of a mishmash.
It's all over the place.
Yeah, it's as kind of absurd as the movie. I mean, it starts off, as I said, with the sing, the big band thing. It ends on "It's My Party" by Leslie Gore. And, you know, I think it's the Egyptian section where it's just playing Swan Lake. And then in between, it's full of these kind of, you have the Sarah's theme, and which turns out to be the main theme as the house is collapsing. But then you've got some really cheesy music that doesn't sound like it would be out of place on Saved by the Bell. It's so schizophrenic at times.
There's a Wax universe they should have gone to in this. That would be incredible.
So I will have to you know, give a shout out to Roger Bellon, who did the soundtrack. So
yeah,
you know, it's as soundtracks go, it's not the worst I've heard. It's very erratic, I would say, but there are some nice cues in there. So. Yeah, we've covered the acting, we've covered the direction. I mean, is there anything on acting, direction, or writing that you want to particularly bring up that you don't think that we've covered?
I think we've covered all of it there, but I think it is in places obvious that it was written in a very short period of time. You can tell that this has not been thrown together, but it was written at pace. And I think the fact that there's all these vignettes in different worlds, I think that helped the writing of it thunder along, because like, quick, this is great, put this idea in, what else can we fit in? And I think that by including the Marquis de Sade and, you know, Frankenstein and the giant talking Venus flytrap and zombies and all kinds of stuff, I think that helped it come together. But it's one of those where I think it was an insane script and everyone else is just going, okay, I'm just going to go along with this and see what happens. And the end product came out far better than it should have for something that was rushed in the writing.
Definitely. I think it never has a chance to be, with the exception of the sequence we've mentioned earlier, it never really has a chance to get ponderous or outstay its welcome.
Yes.
Once you hit that beat, once you hit that victim in whatever it is, it's on to the next one. And here's a new take on thing. And it's almost like picking items up at a buffet.
Yes.
If you know what I mean? So you never get tired of everything.
No, I totally understand. And it only runs 96 minutes and it fills them nicely.
So, we're coming to the legacy of this one now. And there's not been much, we'll be honest. I mean, we look at the legacy of most films on that. The only thing to come out of this is, obviously, there was the sequel, Lost in Time. And did you say you weren't that keen on that one?
I remember not being that thrilled with it. If I remember rightly, it's not quite as insane as the first one, because it's a bit of a slightly lower key, even with the time jumping and stuff like that. I will have to revisit that. I will have to revisit that, because I'm always up for that. And I keep seeing tapes of it dirt cheap.
All right.
I keep seeing it for about a fiver, Lost in Time. And a lot of things have shot up in value lately, so I might have to partake of that and revisit it.
I think it's worth it. Unlike what we've just mentioned, I do think it has a tendency, once it picks a movie that it's, you know, paying a homage to, it has a tendency in the second one to stick with it maybe a little too long, so it kind of outstays its welcome. And then there's a medieval section in the latter half of the film, which, to say it goes on a little too long would be being kind.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is what it is. At least they get that jumping time section, and there's a few nice homages at the end of that one, like, you know, they jump into a kaiju movie, or, you know, Nosferatu or Invasion of the Body Snatchers again. But, I mean, it's worth it. It's worth it. But I don't think it's as on a higher level as the original. I think, depending how you view the original movie, I still think it has that kind of lightning in a bottle feeling about it.
It does. It has that sort of, it has an internal sort of anthology feel to it, Waxwork, and the second one. And while it's not an anthology in itself, it does have that sort of episodic feel where they're going between the different little pockets in the Waxwork universe. And I like it. I think it works well. And if nothing else, it has a legacy of having a really awesome cover.
but it's more than that. It has to be more than that, because, yeah.
Well, yeah, of course.
I mean, I did read a review a couple of days ago, and it's true, actually. It said Waxwork walked so Cabin in the Woods could run.
Yeah, I agree as well, actually. It's a good point. All these things do form the roots of everything that came before. It's like the things that you, by watching this, you see that there's a great reference for things like Night of the Living Dead and things that came before it, Little Shop of Horrors and things. And then you see in things like Cabin in the Woods, there's touches of this, and everything feeds everything else. So no matter how different each era is, there's always an overlap with the previous one.
Yeah. My general view on the movie when I came away from it was, I just want to see more of this. I didn't kind of get it with, you know, Lost in Time. Weirdly enough, a couple of years after, there was I think it was called a Movie Magic Exhibition in Blackpool. I can only guess that a lot of it was hired from Bob Keane, because it did have a lot of props from Hellraiser. It did have a lot of props from Nightbreed. But there was the werewolf from this, he wasn't, you know, sat at a table looking all John Rhys Davies. He was behind some bars, and I can't remember if it was animatronic at the time. I'm old, my memory is wonky to say the least. But I remember just saying, it's the werewolf from Waxwork, and all my friends who've not seen Waxwork were just like, oh, okay, nerd. So so yeah, and apparently there was a comic book adaptation of this by Blackthorn Publishing, who also...
There was, around about the same time it came out, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I read that they've done a Waxwork... They did a Waxwork 3D special also.
Oh, I bet that was great.
Yeah, I'll be probably heading to eBay to have a look for that. I've not had time. So, yeah, I mean, do you think there's anything that we've looked at that you know, we may have missed something, any particular performance or aspect that you don't think we've covered that warrants attention?
It's particularly hard with something like this that is so odd to pick it apart down to its constituent parts. I think we've done a pretty good job, but it's such an oddity, this. I think you have to take it as it's an overall piece rather than its individual bits, because it's all those parts that make it what it is.
Yeah. Do you think it holds up? Do you think it, you know, it deserves its cult classic status?
It definitely deserves its cult classic status. I definitely would say that. And I would say that people that haven't seen it before, that are discovering this era, you know, by going back through all the big name ones, this would be a great addition to their list. But I think it's the sum of its parts. I mean, everyone in this has their good points, their bad points. It could be argued that David Warner and Patrick McNee are kind of not so much phoning it in, but not taking it as seriously as they would as some work they did. You know, because it is just a rubber-filled horror movie, I would imagine, while they're making it. But it was, they still bring class to it. They still bring that little lift, you know, just with their presence.
Definitely. You do get the impression that the younger cast members are maybe trying a little too hard in some respect, whereas they breezed in, got their paycheck, did what they need to do, go. And, you know, everybody's just left in awe, thinking, wow, what a guy, in a kind of Ace Rimmer fashion. So, yeah, anything else that you think, you know, could do with a mention?
Just the value of watching these things. It's interesting to see things from a different era, whether you were in that era or not. And this is a great example of an era which was just ridiculous. It's just this a little period of a few years where we got some very odd stuff. I think Dream Demon was 1988 as well, wasn't it, with Jimmy Nail in it and Timothy Spall and people like that. And that was very odd. And there was a lot of different stuff being tried towards the end of the 80s and the start of the 90s that I don't think gets enough attention, because a lot of the attention is generally on the late 70s and the early 80s with the birth of things like Friday the 13th and the Halloween movies and things and all the big name slashers. But some of the weirder stuff that happened towards the end of that era kind of gets overlooked. It's like when like a toy line gets towards the end of its valuable life, like say Masters of the Universe or something, and all the stuff at the end was just mental, just to try and get some attention. But this was a bit more experimental and a lot of fun.
Yeah, like you said, I mean, modern cinema, if one thing is successful, then people have the capability now to make films on a lot less budget than they used to, so you're going to get a string of the same types of movie. I don't really see many things to compare, you know, things like Waxwork and Dream Demon with, if you know what I mean.
I don't either. Yeah, and I do so look. I'm not like in a retro nostalgia bubble. I do look, and I look hard for new stuff that grabs me. And sometimes I find stuff, but a lot of the time I don't find anything with the same amount of creativity or stuff that's with the brakes off. I want more things with the brakes off.
Up next, it's our standout moments, which we ask if there's anyone performance-wise that makes it for you. You know, is there anyone either acting or character-wise that you just think,
In both senses for me, it's definitely got to be David Warner, because just his presence adds that gravitas. And even with less than stellar lines, just the way he delivers them immediately, you're in there, and it's like, okay, I'm sold. There's something going on with this character. He's up to no good. So for me, it is David Warner. Predictable, but true.
No, I'm in complete agreement with you. I mean, the guy, when he first appears, looks like he's dressed like an elf, and he's still menacing. You can't take that away from Warner. Now, again, anything in the movie that just does it for you? Maybe some element that as a viewer gives you a shiver, a sense of pleasure? This can be anything. Dialogue, a particular scene, effects, direction, anything?
I liked that some of the gore effects went a lot further than other films were doing at the time. I've mentioned the usual slashes and whatnot, and a lot of those don't actually show a great deal of the red stuff. Like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for example, a lot of that is implied. You don't see loads of blood. But in this, you've got heads being crushed. You've got really graphic transformations. You've got blood. You've got the leg with all the skin ripped off, just showing all the stuff underneath. There's a lot of stuff here that goes further than you would expect. And yeah. Even though you're aware that some of these characters aren't real, you know, they're not human, it still packs a visceral punch and is surprising on that level. So, okay, that went further than I was expecting. You're waiting for it to cut away, as a lot of things did, but in this, it doesn't.
Although, listening to you say that, I have a feeling that if anybody hasn't seen the film and they listen to that description and then they go and watch Waxwork, it's really hard. It's still so hard to quantify that they'll sit down, start watching and go, what were they on? What, you know, this is not the same film they were talking about.
And they're expecting zombie flesh eaters with, like, you know, eyes being gouged out and things. And no, it's such a weird experience, this, and you really have to see it to get it. It doesn't make it very easy to review it, does it?
It doesn't. I thought this one would be a doddle, but it really isn't. Yeah, for my favourite, I'm going to have to go with that wake-up scene where everything's coming to life. I think the lighting in that, the flashes, is used so effectively. You know, together with Warner's, you know, run. There's nowhere to run. The direction combined with that, it gives you that oomph. And every time I watch that scene, I could have thought that the, you know, hour and 15 minutes prior to that could be complete cheese, and when that hits, I'm back in. I'm back as that, you know, 12-year-old.
Yep.
So that's us. What about you? As always, we put out the question on social media for what you out there thought of this one, and yet again, you guys didn't disappoint. So once again, we're going to go over to Vianne for people's opinions on this one. How are you, Vianne? Have you seen Waxwork?
Thanks, DK. I actually haven't seen this movie, which surprises me because I looked it up and reading the synopsis, it really sounds like something that would be right up my alley. And I do consider myself a bit of a connoisseur of horror, particularly 80s horror. I really enjoy. And it sounds almost, what's the word I'm looking for? But inspired by the Vincent Price House of Wax, but a lot more fun, maybe. I'm surprised, really, that I don't recall them discussing it in this wonderful horror documentary called In Search of Darkness, which you haven't seen and you're a horror fan. You really got to check that out. But reading the reviews people submitted, it looks like it's pretty well loved. Casey Korzik says, I have part one and two on a double DVD, but only ever watched the first one for some reason. I always really enjoyed this movie. It's a good one. Heidi Johnson Reedy, I really enjoyed this. Peter Scott, like it a lot, but haven't watched it in years. When I was a young teen and first getting into horror, I caught Waxwork 2 on TV one afternoon, probably with a lot cut out, and stuck in my head for years until I finally saw the original. Side note here, don't ever watch horror movies on cable TV. You're always going to miss the best bits. Okay, let's see. What Ian William Green loved this film. Valentina Cruz, all caps, great movie, love it. Also number two. Love to see that excitement. Robert Buskevich, great movie. Sequel is also excellent. Lee Cousins, 4 stars. Classic horror and the perfect midnight movie for a Friday night. I think he is probably correct there. Bobby T-Bone Serna, excellent movie with the rock and roll sign. Robert Kodirish, I hope I said that right, very underrated, a classic good time movie. Callum Barnes, great fun, a real love letter to horror cinema. Steve Boswell, I rented it for 3 straight weeks upon its initial release, and yes, I had a thing for Michelle Johnson. I think that's funny because, you know, we used to, in the 80s and 90s, go to the video store, and a lot of times, and a lot of people, myself included, have reported, you know, the importance of the cover in selecting a horror movie, and looking at the imagery for this, I can see why that would be appealing and why he would end up with it for 3 weeks straight. Steve Barney, great film, could do with a big budget remake. Not sure I agree with that, but having not seen it, I'll withhold judgment. Alan Schultz loved this film. Its use of It's My Party is inspired. Michael Monteleone, I remember when Night Flight showed the preview. It hooked me immediately. Also starring Deborah Foreman, yes please, and Tim Deline, 4 out of 5 stars. So only one actual star rating, but the consensus is it's a great movie. So, you know, in prep for this, I actually looked up where to watch it streaming. So I'm always a sucker for a good horror movie, always looking for the next one to enjoy. So I might have to get this queued up and some popcorn and Diet Coke and give it a watch later. So you guys have inspired me. Back to you, DK.
Nice. Thanks for that, Vian. Now, if you sent us a comment, thank you. We may not be able to read all of them aloud, but we do go through each and every single one of them. So please don't be disappointed if we didn't manage to get to yours. However, as always, we are open to opinions anytime. So hit us up on social media for any of the episodes, not just cult classics, but the regular Silver Screen flavour and our new classic show too. We're always open to hearing what you think. Which now means it's time for us to wrap this up. And hey, somebody has to, with our final thoughts on today's movie. So please, everyone, give it up for Andrew. And Andrew, can you give everyone your conclusion and score out of 5 for Waxwork?
I would give it a solid 4 out of 5. It's not perfect. It is a bit of a fever dream of a film. But I would definitely suggest watching it. It's, if you've not seen it before, definitely watch it. You're in for a cracking time. If you have seen it before, rewatch it just to prove that it was real. Because there's a few things out there like it. And it's just revel in the silliness of it, as well as the horror scenes. Pick out all your favorite movie Easter eggs from it and just have a good time with it.
Nice. And I'm going to say it's cheap, it's cheerful, and it's so full of cheese that a newcomer may disregard this offhand within the first 30 minutes. But if they do, they're missing out. It may wear its budget limitations on its sleeve. The acting on occasion looks as though it's taking place at a scenery-chewing convention. And Anthony Hickok's debut movie, at first glance, looks about as well put together as your average episode of Classic Crossroads. That's one for the UK listeners. However, underneath it is a comedy horror gem that is so full of ludicrous situations and blood-soaked gore that it could only have come from the decade that spawned it. Some effective direction, great effects by Bob Keane, and star turns by Patrick McNee and a moustache-twirling David Warner at his best are just some of the highlights in this. It's funny, it's horrific, it's incredibly horny in places, strangely enough, but above all, it's just damn good fun. For 1.5 hours, it's solid entertainment. It's a vampire movie, a werewolf movie, a zombie movie, a movie about demonic entities and voodoo, an 80s teen comedy, and an exploration of sexuality, strangely enough. Like a horror movie buffet, the thing has a bit of everything, literally. And that's even before the army of old age pensioners show up. Honestly, it slaps. Thank you for this one, Anthony. You did good. And I've also given it a 4 out of 5. So, yeah, I think it's done pretty well, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It held up way better than I expected it to.
Nice. Like I've said in these last few episodes, there's obviously a little less room for variation on scores with just two of us here. But I think the audience interaction bears out our own view, I'd say. I think it's well deserved. I mean, I say it all the time on the show, but it's the nature of the beast with these movies. You feel it's a shame they're not recognised by a wider audience, but those of us who have had the pleasure of experiencing these things, and this is an experience, and the fact that they mean so much to us, we've watched something special, and it brings a smile to our face, and hey, what more can you ask in this than to take enjoyment while you can? Something I'm sure the Marquis would agree with.
Absolutely.
So, oh my goodness, that's it this time around. We hope you've had fun on this one. And you'd be pleased to know that no one was killed during the making of today's show.
So you
this
say.
This one, well, you know, it's been touch and go, but I've managed to keep him alive while we've been recording. You've obviously dropped a comment there that's got the police instantly rushing to your house right now, but there we go. This one, it holds a special place in my heart. So today's been a good one for me. I apologize
yeah, me too,
if I've
man.
talked Oh, nice one. I do apologize if I've talked too much because I'm just so enthusiastic about this ball of weirdness. But I've been glad to share it with such a knowledgeable guest and fellow cult movie lover, Andrew. So thank you. Honestly, thank you for this, pal.
Pleasure being here. Pleasure being here again. Absolute pleasure. I'd love talking about this stuff.
Awesome. Hopefully it won't be too long before you get you back on the show.
Thank you, mate. I'd love to.
Awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. And Andrew's new book, VHS Ate My Brain, The Revenge, is out now. So obviously, please get yourself to Amazon and get that ordered. Maybe Volume 1 while you're at it and some of his other works. as well as that, anywhere the listeners can find you, fella?
You can find me on YouTube, Planet Hex. Look at Planet Hex on YouTube. You can find me on most socials as at Andrew Haunt. That's Andrew Haunt with a W. But yeah, check me out on YouTube. That's where I'm most active.
Brilliant. As always, we'll make sure the links are in the description, so please check that out, everybody. And as always, thank you to you out there for joining us today. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode, as I hope you've enjoyed all our special episodes this month. And if you had fun, please like, subscribe, share, tell your friends, join our social media groups, again listed in the description, and consider leaving us a tip on our Ko-fi account. As I keep saying, we don't do this because it's easy. We do it because we thought it would be easy. So anything you do to help us keep putting out these episodes and talking movies with fellow movie geeks is very much appreciated. We'll be back next month, which at this point is only a few days away. And if you're wondering what we'll be discussing, well, we'll be joined by a couple of returning guests as we take them up to the lab to see what's on the slab. And I really don't think I need to say any more at this point, do I? Until then, thank you once again. Have a great week. We'll see you soon. Until then, remember, they'll make a movie out of anything nowadays.
You have been listening to the Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast, created, written, and hosted by TK. Produced by Mike Wilson. Editing by Nick. Feedback section produced by Lady VN. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.